to watch this unfold on our TV screens every night. I just can't believe.
Hello and welcome to Horsehair Wigs from Irish Rule of Law International and me, Evelyn McClafferty. On the programme this month, we talk to Ray Murphy, a human rights lawyer and professor at the Irish Centre for Human Rights in Galway. Ray talks about the current situation in Gaza and the legality of the Israel-Hamas war.
Now we have a situation where the response by the Israeli Defence Forces, the Israeli military, in my view, has been totally disproportionate. There is a case to answer for genocide.
We talk about the various legal explorations underway at the International Court of Justice, principally South Africa's genocide case against Israel.
Alleging that the state that was formed in response to the Holocaust and to protect the members of the Jewish faith is now perpetrating the very same crime that gave rise to the adoption of the convention, the creation of the State of Israel, and it's been perpetrated against their neighbours in the Gaza Strip, is extraordinarily sensitive politically.
Germany has been a staunch supporter of Israel, historically so because of the Holocaust, but Ray questions the country's backing of Israel now.
What is it about Germany and its support for Israel that makes it somewhat blind towards the horrific, catastrophic, awful human situation that is currently being inflicted on the Palestinian civilian population of Gaza?
We start the conversation with that very point as I sit in Berlin to record this conversation and Ray on the west coast of Ireland. Ray, you're in Ireland, an historical staunch defender of Palestinian rights, and I'm in Germany, a country that has been Israel's second biggest supporter after the United States and arms supplier. Both countries are in the EU, in the United Nations, yet they differ with regard to their political stance on the plight of the Palestinians. How illustrative is this example in the grand scheme of the unfolding humanitarian crisis in Gaza for the need for international legal guidance and overarching binding ruling on what's happening in Palestine?
I mean, first you must look to some extent at the historical background to Ireland and Germany. I mean, Ireland's sympathy and empathy and support for the Palestinian cause is rooted in our own history. And our general support for peoples, groups that are seeking self-determination. It's a matter of historical record that for decades we have supported the Palestinian cause. And Germany feels a special responsibility towards Israel because of Germany's responsibility for the Holocaust. And I actually think that's a reasonable context for Germany's support for Israel generally. And I would applaud it in most circumstances. But at present, in relation to the Palestinian issue, I think that Germany is not an objective observer and is not giving the Palestinian people a fair hearing and not acknowledging the wrongdoing that, in my view, is being inflicted on the Palestinian people. And if you believe in international law, you believe in human rights and the principles, but most importantly, the values that they enshrine. And we're all members of the European Union. And one of the reasons I voted in favor of the last treaty that was promulgated by the European Union was because it enshrined certain values. And those values were human rights and respect for individuals. And most importantly of all, support for and respect for international law and the principles of international law. And in the end of the day, human rights and the principles governing the conduct of hostilities, how military armies conduct themselves on the battlefield, are enshrined in the Geneva Conventions. And so there are rules, there are regulations. And I don't see that there is necessarily a weakness in the nature of the rules or the nature of the principles. The problem is that the system, the framework within which these are placed, is failing us. There isn't implementation and adherence to these important human rights principles enshrined in international law. And we need to ask ourselves why that is the case. So therefore, states like Ireland, we have no choice but to seek a resolution of all international disputes through the framework of the United Nations Charter, which is the preeminent piece of legislation. It's like a world constitution, and through international law. Now, I'm not saying that Germany isn't committed to similar principles, but in reality, we have to ask ourselves, what is it about Germany and its support for Israel that makes it somewhat blind towards the situation, the horrific, catastrophic, awful human situation that is currently being inflicted on the Palestinian civilian population of Gaza? So I believe the answer to seeking to address these issues, these violations, these crises, has to be through international law and the framework of international law, because I don't believe that the use of force is going to resolve issues. It'll just perpetuate them, in my view. So we must have some objective criteria by which to assess the conduct of various parties, not, of course, just the Israeli Defense Forces, but Hamas and other militant groups operating in this theater.
There are a number of legal challenges that are underway at the moment, investigations into alleged war crimes in the Palestinian territories by the International Criminal Court and legal explorations underway at the International Court of Justice. Can you talk us through the core international crimes that seriously violate human rights, war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide before we go into those specific legal cases, just to give us some sort of a grounding as to the arguments?
The first I'll address will be the issue of war crimes, because I think it's the most straightforward issue legally to address. When we're talking about the situation in Gaza, or we're talking about the situation in the West Bank or in the region in general, it's generally accepted. You know, there are a few exceptions by all states that Gaza and the West Bank and East Jerusalem constitute occupied territory. And in those circumstances, the legal framework that applies is international humanitarian law, because international humanitarian law is triggered by an armed conflict or a situation of occupation. For example, at present today in Ireland or in Germany, you can't commit a war crime. We're not at war. But the situation in Gaza and the West Bank, even prior to the outbreak of the current hostilities, did lend itself to the commission of war crimes. And so, therefore, war crimes are set out in the Geneva Conventions, additional protocols, and a whole host of other international treaties. But most importantly, in recent times, is the statute of the International Criminal Court, the so-called Rome Statute. It is the mechanism that's currently being used in the context, not just of the October 7th attacks and the current conduct of hostilities, but even prior to that, what was happening in the Palestinian territories. So war crimes is a violation of international humanitarian law, such as deliberate targeting of civilians or civilian objects, something like a mosque, a church, a synagogue, you know, targeting of civilians. And what's the hallmark of international humanitarian law is a concept known as individual criminal responsibility. The primary purpose of international humanitarian law is to make individuals accountable. It's not actually to make states accountable. Of course, you want to go after states for overall responsibility, but you want to go after, you know, high-ranking officers in the military or in non-state actors, members of government, especially if a government operates under the concept of collective responsibility, prime ministers and presidents, you know, where they exercise command responsibility. In the current situation in Gaza, in the first instance, the attack by Hamas on the Israeli civilians, both in the kibbutz that were attacked, the late night party that was taking place, and the indiscriminate attack on the civilians, the Israeli civilians, in my view, is clearly constitutes a war crime. The taking of the hostages clearly constitutes a war crime. And if it can be proved that there was sexual violence and rape, of which there is evidence to support, then, of course, they're all war crimes. But now we have a situation where the response by the Israeli Defense Forces, the Israeli military, when it launched the operation into Gaza, in my view, has been totally disproportionate, has recklessly endangered civilians. There's been well-documented cases of attacks on civilian objects, hospitals, schools, and non-combatants. And the consequences have been quite horrific, not just the deaths and the injuries, but the cleaning up of Gaza after this operation ends, and it will end at some stage. The amount of unexploded ordnance is likely to be extremely high and extremely dangerous for those that are trying to survive and go back to Khan Yunis or other places that are essentially in rubble. And we don't even know how many people are still buried there. That to me is a shocking figure. And to watch this unfold on our TV screens every night, I find myself, I just can't believe the last time I was as horrified as this was by the attack by the Serbs on Srebrenica, which I'm old enough to recall vividly because we witnessed this on our TV screens each night. We were not unaware of what was happening. And I don't know how we're going to explain to future generations how we let this happen.
The case that you're talking about in Bosnia was labelled genocide. And you have talked about the war crimes or what constitutes war crimes. What then of crimes against humanity and genocide, Ray?
In the first instance, from a legal point of view, let me clarify something. In a situation like Gaza, an incident where civilians are attacked, that's likely to constitute a war crime if it's demonstrated that it's deliberate or whatever. But those acts may also constitute crimes against humanity and genocide. The same set of actions may well constitute all of those crimes. And it's just important that, you know, there's plenty of legal precedent to establish that, especially from the tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. So in the case of Gaza, again, it's very relevant because in the first instance, I would regard that the Hamas indiscriminate attack against Israeli civilians, in my view, had all the ingredients of crimes against humanity, because it was the deliberate targeting of civilians. That's what a crime against humanity is. Now, the targeting of the Israeli military at that time is quite different because they are military. But the majority of victims, in my view, were civilians. That is what the evidence points to. And of course, the taking of hostages in all circumstances is a war crime. But I think there is evidence that that was a crime against humanity. But the consequent military campaign that was launched by Israel, there's overwhelming evidence, in my view, that this is deliberately targeting the Palestinians of the Gaza Strip. You know, the Israelis can claim self-defense in an initial response, and I would not deny the right of the State of Israel to defend itself and defend its people, but I would deny them the right to exercise the degree of force to use the weapons in the way that they have done, to destroy the whole physical infrastructure of Gaza in the way that has happened, and the level of casualties being sustained by Palestinian civilians is on a scale which I have never encountered before in such a short time frame outside of situations like Rwanda, which were quite particular. So we have what is claimed to be a moral army. I'm using the words of Israeli spokespersons there, but from the claimed only democracy in the area. And to watch the conduct of hostilities, the methodology being used by Israel means that they're not actually fulfilling their obligation to distinguish between combatants and legitimate military targets and non-combatants and civilians, whom they are bound to protect. Therefore, to go back to the issue of crimes against humanity, the whole Gaza population seems to be targeted. And that's primarily a civilian population. The attacks being perpetrated now are deliberate. So therefore, you have the ingredients of crimes against humanity. And it's a very strong case in my view. And I believe and hope that in the long run, individuals will be held to account for what has occurred.
If we can look to the law now, then, as an avenue to come to some sort of a two-state solution, there is a happening at the so-called World Court, the International Court of Justice, which is responsible for grievances between states, differing from the International Criminal Court, which holds individuals accountable for various war crimes. Firstly, in 2022, the UN General Assembly sought an advisory or non-binding opinion from the ICJ on, quote, Israeli practices affecting the human rights of the Palestinian people in the occupied Palestinian territory, including East Jerusalem. The Assembly has also asked the ICJ to determine legal consequences arising from the ongoing violation by Israel of the right of the Palestinian people to self-determination and from its adoption of related discriminatory legislation and measures. End quote. The Israelis have criticized the language contained within this request. But can you tell us about the significance of this move by the UN General Assembly, Ray, and how long we should expect for the ICJ opinion, and indeed what weight an opinion will carry?
Of course, all this happened prior to the current outbreak of hostilities following the October 7th attack. So the International Court of Justice is the primary judicial organ of the United Nations, and it is the most prestigious international court that we have. And it's been in existence in one form or another for decades, and is a very effective mechanism for adjudicating disputes or seeking clarification of legal issues. So in my view, it's the most authoritative court that exists, international court, and its rulings carry more weight, though they may not be binding, carry more political and legal weight than do, for example, decisions of the International Criminal Court or International Criminal Tribunals or similar international courts or tribunals. So it's very important. And I mean, it will surprise listeners that the law of occupation is part of international humanitarian law. But occupation of itself is not generally regarded as illegal. It's an acceptance of a de facto situation. One state, a party, has taken over the territory of another and controls it, and it's not an adjudication on the rights and wrongs of this. But after over 60 years of occupation of the Palestinian territories, it's long past some form of adjudication that this is not what's provided for. This was not what was intended. The Geneva Conventions, there's a very comprehensive section of the Fourth Geneva Convention on the laws of occupation. But it's quite evident that it's meant as a temporary legal framework to govern a situation which isn't supposed to last for an indefinite period. So the sheer length of the occupation, but also the fact that the occupation has prevented the Palestinians from exercising their right to self-determination, which is a recognized right under international law. On those two bases alone, and there's even more to support this, the General Assembly was persuaded by overwhelming majority to refer to the International Court of Justice for an advisory opinion to state, well, what is the status of the occupation? We accept that there is an occupation, even if Israel may deny it. So what are the consequences and what may follow from this? And like the International Court of Justice previously adjudicated on the separation wall and the barrier wall between Israel and the West Bank. And some of the rulings are very helpful in clarifying what the legal position is. The court is very authoritative. It's an international court, representative of many different states. And therefore, it has that authority and legitimacy that many other courts or forums don't have. So it can't be ignored. Unfortunately, the rulings aren't binding, but they have huge persuasive value. It's very difficult to dispute it.
How long should we expect for such an opinion?
Unfortunately, it could be up to 4 years. It takes a long time. The South Africa case that was recently brought, we got a preliminary ruling because of the urgency of it. But actually, the determination of whether genocide took place will take years. And determining the legality of the occupation will take a number of years.
You're listening to Horsehair Wigs from me, Evelyn McLafferty, and Irish Rule of Law International. On the show this month, Ray Murphy, a human rights lawyer and professor at the Irish Centre for Human Rights in Galway. Back now to the conversation with Ray Murphy. Let's discuss the South Africa case. So South Africa has brought a genocide case against Israel to the ICJ, to the International Court of Justice. This case was filed in late 2023, instituting proceedings against Israel for its reprisal military assault against the people of Gaza following the Hamas 7th October attacks and kidnappings in Israel. Can you tell us about this case, Ray?
This is an important case. What is genocide? And that's at the heart of this case. So genocide is the deliberate targeting of a group with the intention of destroying it. So you're looking for deliberately targeting a group based on ethnicity, race, religion, or nationality with the intention of destroying that group. You can't, for example, commit the crime of genocide through recklessness because you have to form that intention to destroy. And that's one of the chief legal burdens in proving genocide. And it's one of the major hurdles that the International Criminal Court will have to address, but also the International Court of Justice. Has Israel deliberately adopted a policy to destroy the Palestinians of the Gaza Strip. It's a very sensitive issue, very contentious. I mean, historically, I don't think any reasonable person would deny that the Jews of Europe were the victims of the Holocaust, which would be regarded as, unfortunately, one of the worst attempts at genocide historically. Now, genocide as a crime didn't exist when the Holocaust occurred. Genocide, the convention was adopted in response to the specific targeting of Jews. I mean, many millions of people suffered, but let us acknowledge that the Jews of Europe were deliberately targeted with the view to exterminating them. And that's a horrific crime. So alleging that the state that was formed in response to the Holocaust and to protect the members of the Jewish faith is now perpetrating the very same crime that gave rise to the adoption of the convention, the creation of the state of Israel, and it's been perpetrated against their neighbors in the Gaza Strip, is extraordinarily sensitive politically. It's especially sensitive in Germany. It's even sensitive in Ireland. But we have to look at the circumstances and some of the facts surrounding what has happened. For example, the language used by some of the Israeli cabinet, the Minister of Defense, other ministers like Ben-Gavir, Minister Smotrich, reference to the Palestinians as animals, as subhuman. And especially the Minister of Defense, some of the statements he made when the operation was being launched and in the early stages of the operation, which seemed to dehumanize the Palestinians. That's a very grave issue. Now, it doesn't prove of itself that there is a policy of genocide, but taken as a whole and witnessing what has happened and the blockade of Gaza, the hindrance of humanitarian aid, the prevention of food and other vital medical supplies, and the whole-scale destruction, physical destruction, along with the extensive casualties and displacement of the Palestinian people, there is a case to answer for genocide. I say this having considered it, and I'm also going to give a legal authority, which is one of the best that you can invoke, the preliminary ruling of the International Court of Justice. There is a plausible case to be made that the Palestinian population of Gaza has been subject to genocide.
Yes, so in late January, the ICJ in its provisional order found it plausible that Israel's acts could amount to genocide and issued 6 provisional measures ordering Israel to take all measures within its power to prevent genocidal acts. What has happened since then, Ray?
Israel has ignored that particular ruling from the court. Of course, it has denied that it's committing genocide, and it regularly will say that they are doing their utmost to protect the civilian population, that no army conducts itself as well as the Israeli Defense Forces on the ground. But that rings very hollow in the face of the overwhelming evidence. We have a range of humanitarian organizations. We have the United Nations and a range of UN bodies and other very reputable human rights organizations like Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, all of which are pointing out what's happening on the ground. So as a consequence, South Africa went back to the court because essentially nothing was happening. And the ICJ issued an additional provisional measures pointing out that only by suspending the military operation as demanded by the UN Security Council can Israel abide by the court's orders. So it's reinforcing that call for a ceasefire, which it didn't do in the first provisional. In the provisional measures, a lot of observers were disappointed that it didn't actually say we must have a ceasefire.
So that was the UN Security Council passing a resolution demanding an immediate ceasefire in Gaza, unconditional release of hostages, and the urgent need to expand the flow of aid into Gaza. But this resolution has not had an impact on the ground.
No, it hasn't actually. I mean, in the first instance, which I was disappointed to read, I expected Israel would say that it's not a binding resolution from the Security Council. But the United States has said so also. And I mean, I have it here before me, and you just said it there yourself. Paragraph 1 says, demands an immediate ceasefire for the month of Ramadan, respected by all parties, etc. It is clearly a decision taken pursuant to Article 25 of the UN Charter, which sets out that decisions of the Security Council are binding on all member states. You know, I don't want to get too technical, but I'm assuming most listeners are lawyers. Normally, you know, indicating that the Security Council can indicate that it's a binding resolution by an express reference to Chapter 7 of the UN Charter. But it's well-established law at this stage that the Security Council doesn't have to invoke Chapter 7, and that the resolution clearly is a decision of the Council. But the nature of international law is that people, you know, states will dispute the implications. But I think the great majority of states accept that this is a binding resolution. And I believe the United States believes so too, but for political reasons, it's denying that it's binding, but it has its own domestic agenda, etc. But it's really important that in this instance, it didn't block the resolution. It didn't vote in favor of it. It abstained, but it didn't block it. So that was a watershed moment in the relations between the current administration under President Biden and the State of Israel.
What is the significance of the recent decision by the Irish government to file a declaration of intervention in the South Africa genocide case?
I mean, I welcome the Irish government doing so. I would be a little bit critical of the Irish government for waiting to see how the wind was blowing. That's an Irish expression. You know, before you put your head up and state where you stand, let's just see what the general international environment is like. But better late than never, I would say. So what it's doing is it's reinforcing the legitimacy and importance of this ruling by the International Court of Justice. So I think it is supporting the South African case, and it's supporting this mechanism to try to resolve the international legal and other ramifications of what's happening. And Ireland, as a very small state, has a vested interest in adherence to international law. But I mean, I would be critical that we didn't do so earlier, but I do welcome that we have in principle said that we're going to do so. Likewise, we've announced we're about to recognize the state of Palestine. I expect many of the listeners will be Irish. My question is, why did it take so long?
Separately, Ray, there's an additional investigation underway at the International Criminal Court into alleged war crimes in the Palestinian territories. This was opened in 2021 by the former chief prosecutor. Where is this case now, Ray?
That's a very good question. And I'm going to give you an honest answer. I don't know. And a lot of us are speculating as to what we perceive as the prosecutor, Karim Khan, seemed to lack the zealousness with which he was examining the situation, for example, in Ukraine. And I think what's happened in recent times will have put more pressure on the court. The situation is being investigated by the International Criminal Court, and the very fact that the court accepted jurisdiction itself was a major victory. I mean, it could have been that the court decided that Palestine was not a state, Israel was not party to the statute, and therefore we don't have jurisdiction. But the court determined it has jurisdiction. The situation is now before the International Criminal Court. Since October, there's been a number of further cases or complaints, is the correct term, submitted from Reporters Without Borders. Israeli families, by the way, have also made a claim before the court with regard to the attacks by Hamas on the Israeli civilians in October. And there's a large number of jurists have also issued a complaint with regard to the potential crime of genocide. And again, Palestinian organizations, Al-Haq, Al-Mezen, and the Palestinian Center for Human Rights have also made a complaint with regard to war crimes, apartheid, genocide, and incitement to genocide since October. So the court is busy looking at this situation. And I hope that the prosecutor will be courageous and objective and fair in examining this situation as much as other situations, because it's an extraordinarily sensitive part of the world. Politically, you know, you're in Germany and you can see on the streets how sensitive the issue of Palestine is. On a personal note, I have some close family members living in Germany, and sometimes they're quite shocked at the response of the security, like the police, when there is a legitimate protest about what is happening in Palestine, as opposed to how such a protest would be responded to by the security forces in Ireland. And the lack of, I think, an objective debate about the issues raised by what's happening in Gaza and the Palestinian cause in general. And then I go back, of course, to the historical record. But I just think that's ironic. If Germany continues to give weapons, any type of weapons, any type of ammunition, I believe that it is assisting and supporting what is happening. Because you cannot ensure that it's only going to be used for so-called defensive purposes. That, I think, is a very spurious argument.
Ray, what do you see as the best instruments, legal instruments, in pursuing a viable Israel-Palestine two-state solution, justice for all parties?
Yeah, I mean, politics and law exist in an integrated fashion. When we're looking at how law operates, even at a national level, but especially at an international level, you can't ever take away the political implications, the international relations. It's very naive. Even the International Court of Justice, it is the primary international court, but it also it's a political organ as well as a legal organ. And not to acknowledge this, I think, would be very naive. So I believe the only long-term solution must be through respect for international human rights and international instruments that guarantee the rights of minorities, that guarantee groups the right to self-determination, that respect international law and any adjudicative mechanisms that are used to determine disputes between states, and that we all must support those mechanisms. Otherwise, it's like the Wild West. It's the rule of the most powerful. You know, international human rights and international law, it enshrines values, especially human rights, that emerged from the atrocities of the Second World War. I mean, these didn't emerge out of nowhere. There are really strong historical reasons why we adopted these protective mechanisms. And if we do not seek to support them and strengthen them, we're doomed to continue this cycle of violence over and over again. So I think it's really important to support the United Nations with all its weaknesses. Trust me, I do acknowledge the weakness of the UN system, but international law and especially human rights treaties and instruments that guarantee respect and protection of minorities and others that are most vulnerable. And that's the only way forward in the long run. The law is there, but it's ensuring that states respect and adhere to it and implement it is the great challenge of our time.
Yes, because I think it could be argued that it's woefully failing, actually, given that it is non-binding, given that even the advisory opinion, the provisional order in the South Africa genocide case, still there's nothing happening. But as you said, maybe it's the balance of the political and the legal that actually will get it over the line.
As a lawyer and a supporter of the international legal system, I acknowledge that it supports the status quo. Like if you look at the emergence of many international provisions, they were, especially in the early days, very Eurocentric, and they tended to support the powerful states and were used as a mechanism to reinforce and continue that. I'm giving a very simplistic outline of what I call the third world approaches to international law, the Twail scholar approach, where it acknowledges that actually much of international law framework is very prejudicial to the global south. And we must acknowledge this, that law must be uniformly interpreted and applied in a global way, which is just to all. And I think how especially the global north and the so-called Western states, such as, you know, United States, Canada, European states, Australia, how we approach this particular problem from now on will determine a lot of the relations and respect for international law into the future. It's a litmus test for international law and international human rights. And if the Western states and global north do not live up to their commitments, then they will be responsible in the future for the failure of the international system on a scale which even could be worse than now, because the double standards and hypocrisy are shameful.
Ray Murphy, thank you for your time today.
Thanks, everyone.
And that was Ray Murphy, a human rights lawyer and professor at the Irish Centre for Human Rights in Galway, our guest on the show this month. Thanks as always to our funders Irish Aid, and thanks to you for listening. Until next time, from me, Evelyn McClafferty, and Irish Rule of Law International, take good care.